I truly apologize for interrupting the robust conversations that I know are such an important part of our annual Philadelphia Society meetings. It's often the best part, and I'm sorry to have to wade into the middle of that, but this is the occasion for my more or less annual Urbe et Orbe address to the city and to the world on the state of the society and the conservative movement, and we need to get that out of the way before we can attend to the business of the luncheon. So I apologize for interrupting you, but we want to get underway, and so don't mind me. Please keep eating. Let me ask the wonderful servers from the Sheraton Society Hill Hotel, keep doing what you're doing. Bring on the dessert. Bring on the coffee. And speaking of coffee, I'd like to thank Mr. and Mrs. Dane Starbuck for the wonderful coffee service that we're having here at this meeting. It's very difficult for me to get started given the big news of the day. I've had a very hard time keeping my mind focused on other subjects, given the report that Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are finally engaged to be married. You can see I'm clearly a quiver with this news, or as that guy on television said during the last presidential campaign, feeling a tingle in my leg. It is reported that Brangelina, as they are called, finally decided to get married because they said that same-sex marriage is now legal in the United States. Which leads to a couple of amazing questions. First of all, how did I fail to notice that same-sex marriage was now legal everywhere in the United States? And second, this was an impediment to Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie? What was I missing there? But this wonderful merging of names of Pitt and Jolie into Brangelina, of course, necessarily led me to think of iconic couples in our own Philadelphia society, Phil and Victoria Hughes, Phil Toria. Steve and Lenore Ely Levin. I hope I'm not embarrassing anyone when I disclose that an iconic couple among us are Jefferson Gaynor and Thomas Roosevelt Malick, Mount Rushmore. Well, enough with that. I've calmed down a bit. I do bring you greetings from the President of the United States. A little difficult for me to read this without a teleprompter, but let me do my best. I am honored that the Philadelphia Society, by making America and her detractors the topic of its annual meeting, is devoting its entire session to me and my administration. By meeting in Philadelphia, where our Constitution was drafted, you remind us of the value of studying antiquarian documents. As you know, I have been a professor of constitutional law, and I promise someday I will sit down and read it. I salute you in any event for your deep attention to the work of the founders, by whom I mean particularly Woodrow Wilson, John Dewey, and William O. Douglas. I also bring you greetings from Mitt Romney, whose message reads, "I really love Philadelphia. I myself am a member of society." I think that it is simply marvelous that in the Philadelphia Society, you have brought the two together. I do not mean to make light of the social aspects of Philadelphia Society activity, as I reflected with regard to our conversations, off-the-record conversations. They are an important part of what we do. Sometimes, however, the Philadelphia Society manifests itself as a worldwide fellowship, And I have to tell you an extraordinary story. It's absolutely true. One day last fall, my wife and I were minding our own business, walking across the Charles Bridge over the Vltava River in Prague, the Czech Republic. A beautiful city that preserves probably the greatest collection of standing Baroque architecture in the world. A lot of medieval, magnificent medieval architecture, Renaissance architecture, and then all of the constructions of the Habsburg era, when Prague was an important Habsburg city, imperial city. Being on the margins of World War II, it avoided much of the bombing destruction, and because communist regimes were so darn poor, they couldn't tear down all the beauty. And so Prague remains as an extraordinarily beautiful city, and we were taking it in. I'm walking along across the bridge, and I see a man walking the other way. And I said to myself, that man bears an extraordinary resemblance to Bill Campbell. How very sad, I thought. But the resemblance was remarkable. And then, you know, in sort of my absent-minded way, I looked at the woman walking next to him. And she was really good looking. And I thought to myself, how does this happen? You know, this is a not infrequent reverie for me. How does it happen that a really nerdy guy somehow manages to attract a very attractive woman? And I, turning over in my mind the usual suspects, I'm thinking of Russell Kirk, of whom Bill Buckley once famously wrote, how did Russell Kirk attract the beauteous Annette? Ed Fulner. Steve Ely. Phil Hughes. Me. And then it hit me, my lightning-fast mind, that this lovely woman bears an extraordinary resemblance to Helen Campbell. And you can see the analytical precision with which my mind works. I start to calculate the odds. What are the odds that I would see a man who looks like Bill Campbell and a woman who looks like Helen Campbell in the same time in the same place, if they're not Bill and Helen Campbell? So about 30 seconds later, I turned like a whip and I shouted down the bridge, Bill Campbell! And it was our Bill Campbell. The next day, Bill Campbell's pocket was picked in Prague. And as member-elect of the Philadelphia Society, Stephen Page Smith points out, one day after meeting a guy from Chicago on a bridge, Bill Campbell loses his wallet. Coincidence? Well, speaking of Chicago, this society was founded in 1964, taking the name of Philadelphia because of its attention to the American founding. And as Bill Buckley also once famously pointed out, it's perfectly logical that a society named for Philadelphia would have most of its meetings in Chicago. And that is true for much of the life of the society. Certainly its early life, its annual meetings were held in Chicago. It is only relatively late in the life of the society that many meetings have been held in Philadelphia. We are entering into the age of the demi-centennial of our society. We will be 50 years old in 2014. There is some discussion of holding the 2014 50th anniversary meeting in the city of Big Shoulders, in the Windy City. Rahm Emanuel has sent me here with a mandate to do what is necessary to get the meeting there. I'm empowered to bribe, threaten, do any of the things that have made the current administration such a rousing success and hold such promise for municipal government in my fair city. But that aside, Chicago is in many respects perhaps the most American and at the same time the most Burkean of cities. Annette Kirk would remind us that Edmund Burke once said that civil society is a compact of those who have gone before, those who are alive now, and those who are yet to be born. And in Chicago, they all vote. Well, it turns to me now to make a formal public announcement of the new leadership of the society in this demi-centennial era. We have elected a new president, a new first vice president, a new second vice president, the same old treasurer, and assistant secretary and treasurer. The president-elect of the Philadelphia Society is Lenore Ely. The first vice president-elect, the presumptive successor, a person who will take over Lenore in case anything happens to you, is this man with a lean and hungry look, Edwin J. Fulner. The second vice president, a distinguished practitioner of the law from Washington, one of the leaders of the Liberty Fund, and my brother, Chicago Cubs fan, is Joseph F. Johnson, Jr. Note carefully his exquisite taste in neckwear. Of course, our secretary re-elected is Bill Campbell. And there's no secret, I think, that the Philadelphia Society runs on a Soviet model. The real power in the society is the Secretary General, right? The Assistant Secretary returning to us is Daniel B. Hales of Chicago. And the Treasurer is David Sturr, reelected. On behalf of the Society, I would like publicly to thank those members of our Board of Directors, Board of Trustees, who are retiring this year, Herman Belts, Lenore Ely, Richard Gamble, Phil Hughes, and Giancarlo Ibarguen. So thank you to all of you. New board members who take office at the conclusion of this meeting will be Richard Brake, Edward Fulner, James Otteson, Jane Shaw Stroop, and Bradley C.S. Watson, and Lenore Raleigh. I apologize if I mispronounced Ely. Oh, Lenore Ely. Well, now that's interesting. Because we used to have a bylaw that said that members of the Board of Trustees could not serve successive terms. But I have a note here that says that the bylaws were amended in order to permit Lenore Ely to return to the board and be elected president. Well, it's good to see that Chicago-style democracy has come to the Philadelphia Society. Also, today at the membership meeting this morning, the Society has elected a record-sized class of new members. I've disclosed one of those names. Actually, I've disclosed two now that I think about it inadvertently. One, of course, being the name of Richard Pipes, a distinguished American scholar and hero of the battle for intellectual freedom. Letters to the members-elect will issue requesting them to do us the honor of joining our ranks. Many of these are young people who, by my standards, increasingly pretty much everybody. It holds a great promise for the future of our society. One thing that holds great peril for the future of our society is that the secretary has announced that he would like to retire within 2 years as our secretary. I approach this development with trepidation. I am reminded of what somebody helped me, the former editor of Washington Times. He was the diplomatic editor of Newsweek for years. Arnold Borgrad, once reported as a young reporter, he was interviewing the then American ambassador in Moscow, Soapy Williams, I think it was, G-Manon Williams. There were rumors at the time that there might be a coup against Joseph Stalin. There was some dissension in the ranks. I always said, the more the barrier. And Professor Pipes will correct me if I'm wrong in saying this was Williams, because Williams is truly the butt of this joke, but I believe it was Williams at the time, who said in an interview to Arnold Borkhov, "We've got to support Stalin, we've got to buttress him, because if Stalin left, the successor could be worse." I have similar thoughts about Bill Campbell. Don Lipsett was a tough act to follow. Bill Campbell has performed extraordinary things, admirably well, for the society. Bill Campbell will be a tough act to follow. Bill, say it ain't so. Certainly, respect for the rule of law is a hallmark of the American enterprise, of the conservative movement, and this society's fervent support of the American experiment and our hope to make it a success and to vindicate it in thought, in word, and in deed. President Obama's manifest disdain for the rule of law and other lack of fidelity to founding principles, of course, gives us enormous cause for concern. Against that background, I'd like to be serious for a moment in calling attention to a couple of things that ought to give us, particularly in this society, an enormous amount of pride. There was a famous story by Arthur Conan Doyle in the Sherlock Holmes canon, Adventure of Silver Blaze, where the telling thing was the dog that did not bark in the night. There's an interesting dog that is not barking in this current American night. A dog that we don't hear about in an age of government expansionism and high government debt, of government drowning in red ink and being way in over its head in its ability to meet current debts, let alone the debts that the entitlement systems are generating down the road. We heard warnings from Bill Campbell and others in the course of this meeting so far about the problems of socialism at the local level, and city after city, county after county, state after state across the United States, you hear horrible warnings about the conditions of public sector pension plans. Have you noticed that nobody talks about the danger of a huge unfunded liability for federal civilian employees, that the federal civil service is not underwater in the way that the pension system, in the way that pension systems of other systems across the country are underwater? Now, do you know why that is? Do you know why that dog is not barking in the night? Here's a lesson for us all and for all our fellow citizens. Because 25 years ago, President Ronald Reagan and the head of his civil service saw the problem coming and decided that then was the time to bite the bullet, not to wait a generation or two before the problem became so poisoned that rational responses to it would be impossible. Instead, a quarter of a century ago, in the Reagan years, the administration proposed and Congress enacted a reform of the federal civil service system that converted it from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, drew a line in the sand, and said people who were in the civil service retirement system before that time could stay in it to the end of their days, but people joining federal employment thereafter would be in a new defined contribution federal employee retirement system that was put on a sustainable, actuarially sound, economically sound footing. That happened 25 years ago, and that dog is not barking today. It took enormous courage. It cost the man his job. Congress and others were so mad at the reform. But I hope you know that the guy tasked by President Reagan to achieve this reform, the guiding genius, the father of federal sector employee pension reform affecting a workforce of 3 and more millions at the time, and millions more in prior and subsequent employees and retirees, is and long has been a member of the Philadelphia Society. I ask you please to salute the Honorable Don Devine. Don was the director of the Office of Personnel Management, formerly the Civil Service Commission under President Reagan, author of Does Freedom Work? And Reagan's Terrible Swift Sword, currently with Fund for American Studies, among others. Now, in the same vein, he knows I'm about to talk to him. He's just turned to face me. He's about to turn beet red, as is his wont, because he's a truly humble man, not as Winston Churchill said of Clement Attlee, he's a humble man and he has much to be humble about. This is a guy very well known to you who has nothing to be humble about, yet he's one of the most humble people we know. No discussion of the role of the rule of law or the idea of taking constitutions seriously in modern American times, no serious discussion of this topic can take place without mentioning the name of the 75th Attorney General of the United States. A man whose conduct of his office, in terms of intellectual integrity, dignity, devotion to the American Republic, willingness to take political heat for his boss, the President of the United States, would make wonderful lessons for his incumbent successor. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask you please to join me in honoring Edwin Meese. Now, here are a couple of questions that just come up all the time. Are grits kosher for Passover? Is haggis the national dish of Scotland and Bill Campbell's favorite lunchbox treat ever kosher? Now, where would you turn for answers to vexing questions such as that? Well, I think you'd want to ask an academic who bridged several worlds. A fellow who taught at the University of Alabama and knew from grits. A fellow who taught at the University of Edinburgh and knew from haggis. And a fellow who currently teaches both economics and philosophy at Yeshiva University and knows from kosher. James Otteson is a native of Illinois. The tentacles of Chicago spread far. Like Bob Novak, who spoken to this society in the past, the late Bob Novak. He's a native of Joliet, Illinois. He currently lives in New Jersey, if you want to call that living. He was an undergraduate at Notre Dame University, took a master's degree inexplicably at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. He was already old enough to drink, so I can't imagine the explanation. Took a second master's degree and his PhD in philosophy at the University of Chicago. He's my fellow Maroon. He currently teaches philosophy and economics, as I said, at Yeshiva University, and is one of a longstanding member of our society who proudly wears the society tie featuring the image of Adam Smith. He's been interested in sort of both prongs of Adam Smith's wonderful mind, the theory of moral sentiments, Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith, bridging the gap, so to speak, between, well, philosophy and economics. Is there a moral component to economic life? Is there a connection between the theory of moral sentiments and the Wealth of Nations? In fact, he's devoted a book to that topic, published by Cambridge University Press, I think in 2002, attempting to develop and expound for us a unified theory of the work of Adam Smith. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to present to you the Goyesha pride of Yeshiva University in New York, the Protestant James Otteson.